Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
In this hour of Focus 580, we will be speaking with Bill Fletcher. He is currently the president and chief executive officer of Trans Africa Forum, based in Washington, D.C., an organization that has been around since about the mid-1970s and has for that time had two main kind of purposes. One, to try to persuade the United States government that it's important for it to be in a positive way involved in Africa and in the Caribbean. And the other is to try to educate Americans and make them more aware of what's going on in those parts of the world. He will be here on the campus of the University of Illinois on Monday to give a talk. This is in the MillerCom series. It's the 8th W.E.B. Du Bois Lecture and sponsored in part by African American Studies and Research and the Center for African Studies. The topic is 21st Century Color Lines and Other Lines, the Challenge of Pan-Africanism. And this takes place Monday afternoon, that's the 27th, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. That's on West Illinois Street in Urbana. These programs are always open to the public and free. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. And here this morning on the program, as we talk, questions are welcome, too. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest, Bill Fletcher. As I mentioned, he's president and CEO of Trans Africa Forum and has been since December of 2001. He came to Trans Africa after having spent a number of years working at the AFL-CIO. He is formerly the vice president for international trade union development programs at the George Meany Center at the National Labor College of the AFL-CIO. Before that, he served as education director, later assistant to the president of the AFL-CIO. His union staff experience started in Boston, where he was an organizer for auto workers there, followed after that by his role as organizational secretary, administrative director for the National Postal Mail Handlers Union in Washington, D.C. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, even people listening on the Internet. As long as you're in the United States, you could use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Mr. Fletcher, hello.
I'm here. Thank you for having me on the program.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. As I mentioned, Trans Africa now has been around for, well, since the mid-70s, I guess, when Randall Robinson started the group. And he was, up until the time I think that you took over, he also was the head of the organization for all that time.
That's right.
And it's sort of my understanding that indeed it had these two main kind of thrusts. One was that to lobby, to work with the United States government, to try to persuade the government that it's important for the United States to be involved in Africa and the Caribbean. That, and also to try to educate Americans, and I think particularly African Americans, but all Americans, educate them to the importance of Africa for the United States, the Caribbean, and the importance of our productive involvement, our positive involvement. So, you know, having said all that, I guess I'm interested maybe in having you talk a little bit about Trans Africa and how, when you, at the point that you took over, whether you felt that it was important perhaps for the group to have something of a new focus. Particularly, I guess I think about the fact that, for example, for a long time, I think Trans Africa was very much focused on the issue of apartheid and political change in South Africa. And then when that changed, that would have been a major sort of focus that just wasn't there anymore. How do you think that Trans Africa has changed, or has it changed?
No, it's definitely changed, and you gave a good summation. I would just add to that, the organization began in the mid-70s. The parent organization began in the mid-70s, inspired by the Congressional Black Caucus, that felt that Black America had a very limited impact on foreign policy and needed its own voice to speak to U.S. foreign policy on the African world. At that point, they were particularly focused on Africa, but they weren't exclusively focused on Africa, and we never have been. That's why the name Trans-Africa looks at Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America. And I just want to say that in terms of Latin America, this has been a greater focus for us since I took over. But it has always been a component of the work of the organization. The organization is, as you noted, most well-known for having led the anti-apartheid struggle here in the United States during the 1980s. And that was a very particular moment in history, roughly the period 1983 to 1990, and where the anti-apartheid movement became the cause of all causes. And it was very, very difficult for anybody to be against you, even though Ronald Reagan, then the president, stood against the idea of sanctions on South Africa. The problem that emerged after President Mandela was released from prison in 1990 and the transition to democracy began. It ended up taking 4 years. But the problem was a strategic problem for Trans-Africa, which was that this enemy, this opponent, was now gone or on the verge of going. And what next? And beginning at that moment, but lasting throughout most of the 90s, there was a certain amount of confusion that emerged, both within the organization as well as more broadly. So Randall Robinson correctly and very courageously took on other causes, such as the military regime that at that point was dominating Nigeria, the military regime that overthrew President Aristide in Haiti in 1991, and he took up these issues and attempted to force a change in U.S. foreign policy, the overall notion being that the United States needs to be a global partner rather than a global bully. Unfortunately, what happened, though, is that these issues, as important as they were, for a variety of reasons, did not ignite the same kind of fire that the anti-apartheid movement did. The organization then started a period of slow decline, and while during the 90s Randall and the other leaders of the organization attempted to bring up other concerns, including the U.S. blockade of Cuba and economic policies towards the Caribbean generally, these just didn't catch on. And I took over, I started officially January 2002, and my board chair is Danny Glover, the actor and human rights advocate, and we began a series of discussions after I accepted the job to talk about the building of a new framework. And that basically came down to the necessity to build a black global justice organization to fight for changes in U.S. foreign policy.
Just to talk a little bit about Africa and the criticism that is often made, has been made for a long time, that Africa does not rank very highly on the foreign policy agenda of the United States, assuming that, of course, you would agree with a statement like that and probably say that it was a great understatement.
That's right.
Why do you think that it is? And I think that you have I came across a quote where you said that as a matter of policy, since the time of independence, the United States has played an unproductive role in Africa. So I don't know if you would say that either we have a case of benign neglect or some sort of more active role the United States have played that was not productive. Perhaps you can talk about either why it is that Africa hasn't commanded more attention in Washington, D.C., or why it is that perhaps you might think that the United States has done things in Africa, that Africa policy that we did have was in fact counterproductive.
Both things have been in operation. So with the end of the Cold War, I mean, let me back up. With the 1950s and the developing independence movements in Africa, what's important to keep in mind is that the attitude of the United States towards anti-colonial movements was generally, and I'd say primarily, influenced by the Cold War and by anti-communism. So to the extent to which any anti-colonial movement was perceived by the powers that be in Washington as being influenced by or led by communists, the United States tended to take a position in opposition. Or if a newly emerging government developed contacts with the Soviet Union or with China, the attitude of the United States was almost always to attempt to isolate that government and, in many cases, attempt to overthrow that government through various kinds of coups. And we saw that in Mali, for example, or Ghana, and other places. It's actually interesting to look at the long period that resulted in what now people call blowback in terms of U.S. policy, because the U.S., in standing against left-wing movements and governments, often sided not only with despots such as Mobutu of what was called Zaire, is now called Congo, but also supported right-wing religious movements such as the Muslim Brotherhood in the Sudan or in Egypt. So during the period of the Cold War, rather than the United States supporting anti-colonial movements and supporting the newly emerging countries, the policies were very much influenced by which side of the Cold War line did you find yourself. And this meant that the United States was prepared to support some of the worst regimes humanity has ever known, as long as those regimes took a stand against the Soviet Union. And Mobutu in the Zaire and the Congo is very much a case in point. I mean, they developed a term to describe his regime, which is called a kleptocracy, because this man became one of the wealthiest people on this planet, largely through stealing from his own people. The United States knew how corrupt he was, but as long as he sided with the U.S. in the Cold War, they were prepared to forgive him. Now, when the Cold War ended, you then develop a period of roughly from, let's say, 1991-92 until September 11, 2001, of an ambiguous relationship with Africa, and to some extent benign, well, I wouldn't even say it's benign, but definitely neglect, where the absence of a strategic competitor, the Soviet Union, now led to less emphasis on Africa as of having any real importance. And while, you know, President Clinton during the 90s threw a bone to Africa and to black Americans through the African Growth and Opportunity Act, by and large, there was a great period of neglect. President Bush, when he was selected as president in 2000, came into office and made very clear that Africa was not a strategic priority for the United States. So this changes September 11, 2001, with the terrorist attacks and the question of oil. And it's at that point that there's renewed interest in Africa, largely in direct correlation to the amount of oil in the ground. So whether you're dealing with Angola or Equatorial Guinea, Nigeria, or the southern Sudan, insofar as there was oil in the ground, the United States had a great interest. But they also had an interest in this very ambiguous term called the war against terrorism, so that the United States started to shape policies towards Africa with relationship to the war against terrorism. Now, one of the things that's very important for your listeners to understand is that terrorism, as we understand it, you know, the Al-Qaeda terrorists, that's not been a major problem in Africa. Civil wars, ethnic conflicts, poverty, HIV/AIDS, class polarization, these are major problems facing the continent. Terrorism is not. So the United States, in responding to the so-called war against terrorism and looking at Africa, has ended up further militarizing a number of countries where you, in fact, need to demilitarize the situation.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. I'd like to do that and invite others who are listening to do that as well. If you'd like to call in, questions, comments, welcome. The number here is Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And our guest this morning is Bill Fletcher. He's president and chief executive officer of Trans-Africa Forum in Washington, D.C. He'll be on the campus of the University of Illinois on Monday to give a talk, and he's been good enough to spend some time with us here on the phone talking because it would have been nice to have him here in the studio next week, but he was just going to be too busy when he was here. So we're talking here this morning in advance, and we're glad to do that. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we have someone here on a cell phone, a community not too far away from here, Gibson City, line 4. Hello.
Hi, David, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Yeah, hi. Enjoying the program. Very provocative. Just as a commentary, I can't imagine a country more important to the world community than Africa, and it breaks my heart every time I hear a story coming out of there with the people there and the way things are going. I'm hoping that the work that Mr. Fletcher's doing. Things can be turned around, and so I want to applaud Mr. Fletcher for his work. I do have a comment, question, and since I'm on the cell, I'll go ahead and ask it and ring off and listen
sure.
off the air. There was a story coming out, maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks, and it's an old story, but maybe updated with the plight of the what was the white farmers in South Africa and the food production, and really the sanction of that corrupt government to chase them out of the country, those that left and perhaps those that were killed outright, whereas now they're trying to be invited back because the food production has gone south and the people obviously are starving to death. And I was just wondering if Mr. Fletcher had any comment on that story and if that situation could possibly be turned around. And I'll go ahead and hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your comments and your questions, caller. The issue of the white farmer is in South Africa and Zimbabwe, but I think what you're talking about, it was the expulsion of farmers from Zimbabwe and the occupation of the farms. And I think what's important for your listeners to understand is that in Southern Africa, there has been a major land question since the beginning of colonialism. That essentially what happened was that the colonists came into Southern Africa and they expelled the indigenous people from their lands. And they seized the lands and gave them to European farmers who then began cultivating various crops, largely for export purposes. So in the struggles for freedom, one of the fundamental questions was land redistribution. Getting the land back in the hands of the people, the indigenous people of those countries. When Zimbabwe became free in 1979, there was a discussion about land redistribution, and it was agreed that during the first 10 years of freedom that there would be no forced removal of the farmers, but there would be a policy called willing seller, willing buyer, and that the United States and Britain would help to fund this. And the basic idea was that the European farmers, the white farmers, would be encouraged to sell their lands to African farmers who wanted to cultivate it. But there would be no compulsion to do that. The United States, as it often does, reneged on this deal. And there was very little transfer of land during that time. It was also the case that President Mugabe had a very good relationship with the white farmers up through the mid-1990s and did not want to rattle that. By the 1990s, a land movement had started to develop, and this movement was putting pressure on President Mugabe for land redistribution. Now, President Mugabe largely ignored, if not opposed, this movement until the late 1990s when something interesting happened, which was that he himself was being challenged for power. A movement was developing largely among Zimbabwean workers, that was saying that the economic policies that President Mugabe was following, policies that were very much in line with what the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and, yes, Washington, D.C., wanted him to implement. But these policies were hurting the Zimbabwean workers. And so a movement developed that challenged President Mugabe. It was at that moment that there was this incredible flip-flop by President Mugabe, who then decided to embrace the land.
I think we might have lost the guest there. I tell you what, occasionally this happens. We do have little phone problems. We, I'm sure, can put the telephone call through again and get him back here and get back with our guest, Bill Fletcher. Let me just, since we're almost at the midpoint here anyway, and I would be doing this, let me do that, reintroduce the guest. This morning we're talking with Bill Fletcher. He's president and chief executive officer of Trans-Africa Forum and has been since December of 2001, taking over from Randall Robinson, who had led the organization since the mid-70s when he started it. Mr. Fletcher comes to Trans-Africa after having spent a long time as a labor organizer working in the AFL-CIO. He is going to be on the campus of the University of Illinois on Monday to give a talk in the Millercom series. This is the 8th W.E.B. Du Bois lecture, sponsored by African American Studies and Research and the Center for African Studies, talking on the topic 21st Century Color Lines and Other Lines, the Challenge of Pan-Africanism. That's Monday, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. That's on West Illinois. All of these events are always free and open to the public, so anyone who is interested in attending can do that. And of course, here on the program, calls are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And I think we have you back now, Mr. Fletcher.
I'm back. I guess someone didn't like what I had to say.
Well, there's always that danger.
You're
going to say something that's going to... I hope that that is not what was going on. Anyway,
sure.
So
in
you
any
can
case,
get... Yeah.
Where I was that...
Right.
Mugabe embraces the land movement as a way of rallying support to his regime. And the land movement begins these occupations that were carried out in a fairly chaotic way. And ironically, the people that had been working the land, I don't mean the people that had owned it, but the black farm workers were themselves expelled from this land, and they were replaced by these occupants who, in many cases, were completely unprepared to take up farming. And so that was the crisis that the caller was mentioning. Now, in South Africa, there's also a land issue. The government is taking a different attitude towards it, but in my humble opinion, is moving very slowly in terms of land redistribution, and that it's actually a powder keg. But I think it's important for your listeners to understand that this land had been stolen from the indigenous people and given to these white farmers who held it for this amount of time. And basically what's being asked for is a democratic redistribution.
Mr. Mugabe is a character about whom I think a lot of people feel rather conflicted, to say the least, because on the one hand, he certainly has an important place in the history of his country because he was very important in ending white rule in what was Rhodesia. At the same time, now... country is in bad shape. The economy is in bad shape. There's a lot of unemployment. I think that there have been allegations of government corruption problems with the recent election in which he was reelected. And for all of those reasons, I think that there's reason to criticize him, at least recently, and his government recently. Though, do people have a hard time doing that? I mean, given his place in Zimbabwe, what he had accomplished, is it difficult now for people to say, but now we really have a problem and take it really even far enough so that they would say perhaps Mr. Mugabe should not be in power anymore, should step down?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The President Mugabe was a hero for many of us here in the United States for the reasons that you outlined in terms of his leadership of the struggle for freedom in Zimbabwe. The difficulty, and this is one of the reasons actually I believe in term limits, I think that sometimes people overstay their position and they become too wedded to their position and the power of the incumbency becomes too great. So I wish that perhaps after two terms, President Mugabe had stepped down and there had been younger and new leadership. It's very difficult for many African Americans to speak up against President Mugabe, in part because of who often stands against him. For example, President Bush and Prime Minister Blair. So each time that President Bush opens his mouth and criticizes President Mugabe, in the minds of many people, they say, well, you know, we saw what Bush did in Iraq. We see what he's threatening against Cuba, Venezuela, and other places. So if he's attacking Mugabe, then maybe there's something right about Mugabe. And I understand that thinking, but it just happens not to be correct. When you go to Zimbabwe, when you talk to activists on the ground in Zimbabwe, there's a very different point of view. But I think for many of us here, because of the way that President Mugabe has been attacked by the political right in the United States, it's very easy to just remain silent or to, in fact, get behind Mugabe.
Well, let's talk with some other folks who are listening. Urbana. Next, we have someone in Urbana. This is Line 1. Hello.
Hi, how are you? My ex-neighbor's brother was a Catholic, I don't think, relief worker is not the right word. He educated indigenous farmers in Zimbabwe in modern farming techniques, and he had to leave the country because he was put on a death list and take his family. He's married to an English citizen, and I think, as a matter of fact, the British Army actually had to get him out. But so I did have a chance to talk to him, you know, a year or so ago about that. And I think this whole Mugabe thing is being, I mean, you're being a little too soft on this guy. I mean, he's jailed all of his political opponents, and he's basically a dictator, and he's like a lot of these people. I mean, you're right, he's overstayed his welcome, but he's not going anywhere. And he may be responsible for, what, 250,000 people in his own country starving to death? I mean, and I understand the Western view of this and colonialism and the United States' polemics during the Cold War. But, I mean, the West, other than exploiting some of their resources, and I'm sure that's still true, but, I mean, it's to whitewash the indigenous leadership in these countries, especially in the former Congo and in these places where they kill, you know, these people murder each other at rates that's almost unheard of. And I know they're armed by the West, or supposedly. I mean, I just don't, you know, I'm all for, you know, everybody should, if we just, why doesn't the West stay completely out of Africa then? You know what I mean? I don't understand. I, from having talked to that guy and realizing that he had, you know, I mean, I don't know what he, maybe he was, seen as a white exploiter. I doubt it. He had a doctorate in farming techniques, and he basically helped people learn how to farm more efficiently. And I do agree with you that historically these people's lands were taken, and I know all that stuff. I mean, that's history. We, you know, we can't change that. But I think the situation in Africa is not as simple as everybody wants. You know, like, well, the white people went in. I mean, right now we're all manipulating everybody. These people are pretty much killing each other on their own. So I don't know. I just thought I'd say that. Thank you.
Well, yeah. Well, Mr. Fletcher, you can respond to that however you like.
Yeah. It's an interesting point of view. I think, first of all, I'm going to be the last person to whitewash so-called President Mugabe. But I think that it's critically important that your listeners understand the historical context as to what's happening. And in the United States, we have this tendency, and it was reflected in something the caller said about, you know, well, that's history and there's nothing we can do about it. That's actually not true. You know, the whole notion of repairing the damage that's done, that is being held accountable, there is something that the West can do, and including the United States. I mean, the United States, for example, was directly culpable in the destruction of Angola and the creation of a civil war that started in 1975. We can't simply say, well, that was history, there's nothing we can do, you know, kind of get over it. So I think that's one issue that's critically important. I think that the issue of the sorts of conflicts that are going on in Africa speak to one of the reasons that, you know, you've had the growth of this creation of this organization called the African Union, which is the successor of the Organization of African Unity, to attempt to address continental unity and subcontinental unity at the basis of regions. You have divisions in Africa, some of which are absolutely legacies of colonialism. And you can't walk away from that. These borders that were created for these different nation states are essentially irrational. And they therefore create problems that those countries continue to have to deal with. Cameroon is an excellent example of that, where you have this very bizarre situation that was created. So the people of those countries absolutely have to settle account with their own leaders. The issue of Mugabe, the people of Zimbabwe are going to have to settle that. I think that the West is not going to walk away from Africa precisely because Africa is so valuable. When you look at many of the natural resources that are necessary for computers, they're found in Africa and specifically found in the Congo. So I don't think that the West is going to walk away. But the problem that is that needs to be addressed is that the West needs to play a productive role in Africa as opposed to completely stirring things up. You know, you look at the Rwanda genocide in 1994. One of the factors that is almost never discussed is the role of the French, who continued to arm the Hutu government, even though the governments of France, Belgium, the United States, and others knew that there was a very high likelihood of a Hutu genocide against the Tutsis. So it's not that the West is blameless in this situation. So while I have some sympathy for what the caller is raising in terms of the fact that the people of these countries have to settle the situation, you can't simply say, that was then, this is now, get over the history. Hmm. We're standing on the shoulders of that history.
We have some other folks I'd like to talk with. Let's go to next to someone listening in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Another excellent program. I certainly wouldn't say you've been whitewashing Mugabe, but my question is to offer you a platform to more or less sketch what you think should be done, how it can be done, and, you know, the probabilities of the outcome in regard to the United States and Britain, France, you know, basically the White West, dealing with this situation. Since you brought up the thing I was going to ask you about the certain metals and ores and things that are available in Africa, particularly for high technology, that we're going to be in there a long time, and we're going to have business people pushing buttons here and there, and I'd just like for you to somewhat of, if you could, you've done an excellent job so far. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you very, very much, caller. In terms of what I think the United States should do versus what I think the United States will do, I would start here that when the G8, the Group of Eight countries, meet, at least the last couple of times, there's been discussions about Africa. There have been promises made, but they haven't been followed through on. If what I would have recommended that the United States do is to meet with the leaders of the African Union to begin discussions about what sort of constructive assistance can the United States offer for strengthening governance, the economies. One of the things that the United States needs to get away from is dictating what countries need to do in order to get assistance. I mean, we have to face certain facts in the United States, and they're very, very difficult. People don't really want to talk about this. The United States would simply not be where it is today had it not been for Africa. And I don't mean that simply in the sense that all humanity started in Africa 200,000 years ago. What I mean is that the combination of the slave trade and the exploitation of the resources and the people of Africa brought great wealth to Western Europe and the United States. Therefore, there is a discussion that needs to be taking place about what can we do together as partners with African countries. So, for example, we should not be so quick to start sending weapons into what's called the Maghreb, the region essentially south of the Sahara, to fight this so-called war against terrorism. What that region needs, really, is help with the continuous expansion of the Sahara, issues of water, water purification, job creation, issues around the other issues around the environment. I mean, so, but But what happens, unfortunately, is that geniuses sitting in Washington determine what's necessary for Africa rather than talking with the leaders and the peoples of Africa about what could be done. So I think that there's a constructive discussion that could be taking place between the United States, Britain, France, other countries, and the leaders of Africa. And unfortunately, what ends up happening is that the leaders of Africa end up acting as if they have to go to the Group of Eight, hat in hand, begging for support. I mean, it's insulting to anyone with African blood in their veins that this is taking place. That's why I think that a different sort of arrangement needs to happen. I don't think that that's likely right now without a change in political power in the United States, in part because, again, and it goes back to the earlier caller's comments, we in the United States don't want to deal with history. We never want to deal with history. We don't want to deal with the ramifications of things that we've done. We'd rather ignore that and act as if we're always beginning with a level playing field, and we're not.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Just very quickly, let me introduce again the guest, Bill Fletcher. He is president, CEO of Trans-Africa Forum, based in Washington, D.C. It's an organization that has been around since the mid-70s that was formed to do a couple of things, to try to lobby the U.S. government to be involved in a more positive way in Africa, the Caribbean, and now also Latin America, and also to educate Americans about issues in those places. He'll be here on the campus on Monday to give a talk and hear questions. Welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up, we have a caller in Champaign County. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so glad to hear you outline what's called the Lancaster House Accord and the betrayal of it. And I heard your criticism of Mugabe for, you know, going along and getting along. It's not a critique that people are used to hearing, but yeah, I don't think you were apologizing for anything Mugabe has done. But you also talked about it in a nuanced way that, you know, if you start getting criticized by Blair and Bush, people will rally around. You mentioned the powder keg of South Africa, and it seems to me that there's an unspoken story of the deal. You know, we're all quite happy with the transition and the power-sharing agreement, but a lot of that was already, you know, the World Bank and IMF didn't have to come in and structural adjust because the commitments had already been made. And what's happening now is that the kind of privatization and lack of land reform, et cetera, is just exacerbating a very dangerous situation. So I just don't think people have any sense of that nuance. And I also think that people have this really shallow assessment that the U.S. is doing so much already, which is just, you know, when people are asked about how much percentage of foreign aid is of our budget, they just have this outrageously ridiculous impression. The U.S. and the world community, the North, as it were, is extracting more money out of most of Africa. I mean, they may have cut some deals with the extremely lesser developed countries that with some debt or forgiveness, but I'm not even sure if those have actually resulted in a net investment in Africa as opposed to an extraction. And the Millennium project that Bush was touting so much in various State of the Union addresses, et cetera, has just gone off the page. There's no acknowledgement of it all. And I applaud you for keeping your cool with the kind of I think extremely ignorant attitudes that we've heard in a couple of speaker, because it just makes me absolutely feel like I just have. And I know the time is short, so I'll hang up and listen to your comments. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thank you, caller. But you know, the one difference I would say is that I actually appreciated the calls from the earlier speakers, and I think that what we have to recognize is that we get so little accurate information in the United States about what's going on in Africa, and people draw all sorts of conclusions. So I very much appreciated the fact that the call is called in with their comments and questions. What I would say is that in terms of South Africa, what many of us don't appreciate is that while the political democracy was won, it was won on a basis of compromise. Now, what were the circumstances of that compromise? there was not a military victory by the African National Congress or the Pan-Africanist Congress of the Zania over the South African apartheid government. South Africa had developed nuclear weapons with the assistance of Israel. They also had biological weapons. They had a very strong military. It was very difficult for the ANC or the PAC to have military bases in South Africa. On the other hand, the apartheid government was becoming systematically isolated internationally, and things were unraveling. It was in that context that a compromise was reached. But the compromise included effectively that political power would be turned over to Africans, to blacks. Economic power would largely remain in the hands of whites. And one of the insults of this entire situation is that the ANC government agreed that it would repay the apartheid debt. That is, that the debt that the apartheid government had accumulated internationally in order to stay in power, their debt by buying weaponry and et cetera, that the ANC government agreed that they would repay that, as repudiate that debt. When the African National Congress was elected in 1994, President Mandela came in. Shortly thereafter, as you were referencing, caller, there was a decision by the government to essentially jettison its original economic plans and to pretty much embrace the sort of what's called neoliberal economics, the economics of privatization that were being promoted by Geneva, Washington, and London. And this has led to a major problem in South Africa, because if you go to South Africa, very, very beautiful country, you still have the greatest wealth polarization on the planet. And there's a massive demand for land redistribution and wealth redistribution. And it is a powder keg. And it's been amazing to me that the situation has remained as relatively calm as it has. I don't know how much longer people can put up with it. The levels of poverty are just absolutely amazing. And while there have been changes and certainly advances since the end of apartheid, I think it's fairly clear that it hasn't gone far enough or fast enough.
All right. Again, we'll see if we can get some more callers in the time that remain. Next in line is someone in Champaign, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Well, I'm a little frightened to make this point. I'm sure the last caller will call me ignorant as well. I agree with your point that the past shapes the future and it shapes the present as well. That's a true statement, I believe. The question is, at what point can the people of Africa in African countries be held accountable? I believe in things like the strong should help the weak, but I also believe that people should at least try to help themselves. In Africa, we hear so many stories about the, it seems like, entrenched behavior of self-destruction. They're not taking care of the AIDS epidemic. They're not taking care of the food problem. They're not taking care of just getting peaceful relations within countries, let alone between countries. And how long is Europe and the U.S. going to be held accountable for things that happen in the past? So I'd just like to hear your perspectives. I apologize. I don't mean to be offensive. I'm just kind of curious. And if I'm ignorant, then there it is. Thanks. I'll listen.
I take no offense to the question, and it's a very important question. I think that the first thing is that the people, the leaders, have to be held accountable for current activities, and there's no question about that. But the problem is that the relationship of the West to Africa is not simply in the past tense. It continues. The debts that the countries of Africa have to pay the West for loans that were very often forced upon them and forced upon despotic governments in the 1970s, these loans, the interest from these loans, ends up draining the national treasuries of many countries. So when you say the issue about taking care of victims of HIV and AIDS, well, one of the ways to look at that is that countries that are forced to take a significant percentage of their national income in order to service a debt have less in order to pay for public services. And this has been a major problem in the continent in terms of dealing with public education, public health, transportation, and other aspects of infrastructure. So it's not simply in the past tense that we're dealing with it. We're dealing with the current situation. The matter I mentioned in terms of the French involvement in the Rwanda genocide is also the case. The fact that the U.S. during the Cold War was arming to the teeth various extremely repressive governments. So you have these factors that are all there that are going on. It is a current problem. It's not just what happened in the past. And so I think that that's one of the reasons that we in the United States have to hold our own leaders accountable. But let me give you another example. In terms of the issue of HIV/AIDS, so the Bush administration makes this commitment to help Africa fight AIDS. It turns out it wasn't just Africa, although that's what his speech said in 2003. So in any case, he makes this commitment. The United Nations has a very effective mechanism called the Global Fund to combat HIV/AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. Now, we have the Bush administration is supposedly a conservative government that is not interested in bureaucracy. Instead of fully funding the UN Global Fund, they give some funding to that, but then they create their own fund to deal with HIV/AIDS, which therefore needs to be built up. So they create a new bureaucracy. And that new bureaucracy, in providing assistance to countries in Africa to fight HIV and AIDS, what do? They demand that those countries buy not generic pharmaceuticals, but patented pharmaceuticals, which means that the countries have to pay more. They also demand that as a condition of getting assistance, that they have to, they cannot promote condom use. They have to promote abstinence. So when you have a situation like this, what you're seeing is not a partnership. You're seeing effectively bullying and a continuation of drawing resources out of the continent. So unfortunately, we can't simply say, well, that was then, this is now. The blood is continued to being drained from the patient.
I think we still have the issue on the table of the demonstrated lack of ability, everything from lack incompetence to outright corruption that many governments in Africa have just done a very, very poor job in taking care of their people post independence. Now you can say that they weren't, that when the colonial powers left, they really didn't do anything to try to get them on their feet and have continued since that time to try to exploit them to the extent that they could. But at the same time, it is something that that many people in Africa will come right out and say, there has been on the African side in many instances a real failure of leadership.
No, that is very true, and it's something that countries and peoples in Africa are attempting to address. I mean, you have situations like Mozambique, South Africa, Namibia, Botswana, and Kenya, Tanzania, where there have been active efforts at democratization, improvement, fighting corruption, things along those lines. All of that is true. But I think we have to add a little bit to this picture so that everyone understands exactly what we're talking about, that many of these countries are facing massive ethnic conflicts that are the results of these irrational borders that were created as a result of colonialism that have put together peoples that had no particular reason to be together. On top of that, during the Cold War, which only ended in 1990-1991, the West and the Soviet Union were often arming governments and strengthening their repressive arms, the police, the military, etc., at the expense of civil society, at the expense of democratic governance, because they were more concerned about the chessboard in the Cold War. So you end up having these very, very distorted situations there. Just think, for example, when you think about ethnic tensions, I just want to bring this on home. When you think about the growing anti-immigrant sentiment in the United States, just imagine if many of the anti-immigrant forces were armed with M16s, and where there was very little history of an effective police arm. I mean, just think about the kind of vigilantism that the U.S. West saw for decades. Think about the lynchings that have taken place against African Americans. I mean, it's not just that there are these problems in Africa and why don't they get it together and why can't we all get along? I mean, in our own country, we have a lot of experience with corruption, with random violence, with racial and ethnic hatred. I mean, so these are factors, and we didn't have in the United States, by and large, external forces, external governments intervening in how various things got handled here. Africa, unfortunately, can't say the same thing.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. I must apologize. We have a couple of callers we can't take, but we're here at the end of the time. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, our guest, Bill Fletcher, will be here Monday afternoon to give a talk. This is the 8th W.E.B. Du Bois Lecture, 21st Century Color Lines and Other Lines, The Challenge of Pan-Africanism. This is Monday at 4 at the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor. That's on West Illinois Street in Urbana, open to anyone who would like to attend. Bill Fletcher is president, CEO of Trans-Africa Forum, based in Washington, D.C., and if you have internet access and you want to find out more about TransAfrica, they do indeed have a website, which is transafricaforum.org, or just put TransAfrica Forum in your browser, and I'm sure that you will find it, and you can find out all about them. Mr. Fletcher, thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much.